This story will not be the same as the ones that you've heard to this point. I promise you this next part of the story will change immediately when you hear Robert speak. A young man who spent his youth in England. At the time that they're talking about leading up to World War II, Great Britain has been in World War II for a while. And his story of his childhood, it will be vastly different because it's influenced by those events. So why don't we talk about you being a kid growing up and, you know, up till 40, 41, when the Yanks finally caught up with you.
Well, you gather I'm a resident alien. I should tell you I'm very legal. I have to renew this every 10 years. In fact, I did it last year. And they used to just take your thumbprint because of 9/11 and that. I went the other day, and they do the whole damned hand and always run to 10 fingers and thumbs. But I don't mind. I'm quite happy to do that. Right. Well, I'm the baby of the group. You probably gather that. And it'd be pretty boring about my early life in England because it was wonderful. I just had the most marvelous life. And then bloody old Adolf came along and screwed it up, you know. So anyway, I was born into a military family. I have to explain this because otherwise you think, what's this little fellow doing what he did when the war started? So when I was born, my father was an old, beautiful veteran. He'd been in the army 34 years, and he'd fought in the Boer War, and he'd fought in the Great War. And Dad was born in 1871. He was a friend of Churchill, who, in fact, he was 3 years older than Churchill. Churchill was born in 1874. And Dad was in the same regiment. He was a fellow officer with Churchill, because Churchill, as you probably know, was born in Blenheim Palace. I have to explain this. Blenheim Palace was where the Duke of Marlborough lived. Duke of Marlborough was his uncle. That's where Churchill was born. So Churchill was in the regiment for a while with Dad. And Dad fought with Churchill's brother, Jack. He was very friendly with Jack. They were great buddies all through the Boer War, all through the Great War. So I had the wonderful advantage when I was born that I was born to be a soldier, which I was for 12 years, a little bit later on. And so I listened to everything that was said. We had no, as these beautiful people here have told you, when in our youth, in the 30s, no television, no computers, nothing to distract us, just having a wonderful life wherever you were living, in the country or the town. I lived in the country on the early Jersey estate, and it was wonderful. So my first 8 years of life were marvelous. However, I was aware of what was happening in the world. You couldn't help but be aware because we had papers, we listened to the radio. That was our life's blood. 6 o'clock every night, the BBC News would come on. You know, do you know what Big Ben is? It's that lovely big tall, it's not the building, it's a clock that's Big Ben, next to Westminster Palace. 6 o'clock every night, it would boom out all through my life in England. And on would come the BBC News. And the BBC News was spoken every night by a guy called Alvar Liddell. Now, that doesn't sound very English, does it? And that's probably why I remembered it for 70-odd years, you know? But then we also had a relief announcer called John Snagg. That was a little more British. I like that one. Anyhow, 6 o'clock every night, Alvar Liddell would come on and tell us the news. Why I'm getting around to this, that when we eventually went to war, which was on September 3rd, 1939. That was 2 days after Hitler invaded Poland, although he promised us he wouldn't do it. We all knew about it. In my family, perhaps the other kids in where I lived didn't, but I certainly did, because I used to sit in the corner in those wonderful days, gentlemen. Little boys could be seen but not heard. So you could sit there with your grown-ups, and you could listen, but you didn't get involved. So I used to sit there, and Dad would sit with all these beautiful old veterans who would visit, who he'd fought through all these wars with. And we'd talk about world, they'd talk about the politics. So by the time the war started, I was well-versed in what was going on. Didn't come much as a surprise for me. We had prime minister at the time called Neville Chamberlain, who was, perhaps I'm being rude to him, but he was a lovely fellow, but he was a pacifist. So he used to keep popping over to Germany to see old Adolf. And he'd come back and he'd say, oh, had a little chat to Adolf, Mr. Hitler, he used to call him, Mr. Hitler, and everything's going to be all right, you know. And in fact, in 1938, he came back from his last meeting with Hitler, which took place in Munich. And it's a famous picture, which you've probably heard about from your professors, where he waves a bit of paper, peace in our time. Well, by then, you know, Hitler was in the Czech Republic. He'd got Austria, and he was bordering on to Poland, and he had a lot of desires in Europe, as you're probably aware. So it was all lying and cheating. But dear old Neville, he thought you can talk to this wonderful man, but you can't talk to somebody who wants to either kill you or occupy you. I mean, that's history, okay? Talk all you like, but they'll do what they want to do. So when he went into, when Adolf went into Poland, as I told you, on the 1st September, only took him about a couple of days to take Poland over because he had the might of the Third Reich. And then on, it was a Sunday morning, I can always remember, I'm 8 years old, 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning, September the 3rd, 1939, and we went to war because we'd promised Poland that if he was they were invaded, that we would support Poland. And being men of honor, we did. And women of honor, sorry about that. Persons of honor, I have to be very careful to be politically correct or whatever nowadays. So anyhow, war started, but what why I told you all this was because we were totally unprepared. Dad, of course, being a pal of Winnie, Churchill, knew what was going to happen. Winston was looked upon, sadly, as a warmonger because he warned everybody in Parliament, because he was in Parliament, and he said, look, you've got to be prepared. The Adolf's coming, etc. And they ignored him. Neville Chamberlain thought he could talk Adolf out of it. Well, he couldn't. So anyhow, we're suddenly at war. And everything changed overnight. So I'd had, like these lovely people, I'd had eight idyllic years in my life, which was just perfect. It was wonderful. And it changed overnight. So first thing that happened, of course, was we sent a British expeditionary force over to France to protect France and stop Adolf coming over any further into Europe. Well, as you probably know, the English, French, we were outnumbered about 3-1. And within about 6 months, we were back in England after Dunkirk. We had lost thousands and thousands of men, sadly, although we saved about 250,000 and got them back to England. But they had to leave everything behind. So suddenly, there's little old England, which I was living in, and we'd got some of our troops back. Others had been killed or captured, of course, by the Germans. But they'd lost all their equipment, so we didn't have any equipment. So we couldn't go back to war because we hadn't got anything. We'd left it tank. Well, we didn't have tanks then. What we had mainly, which we'd left over there, was trucks, guns, ammunition, and all that. So we'd lost all of that. So we were in a perilous state. So first thing we did, of course, we knew that we were going to be bombed by Hitler because he'd done it to everybody else, so why should he leave us out? We also knew we were going to be gassed. Anybody see the Chronicles of Narnia? Good. Well, there, as you probably know, they had all these little evacuees came from London and they put them up into Oxford, where I was living at the time, and that's where C.S. Lewis wrote that. And I was only going to say, if you saw the film, little boys and girls who came from London, they all had these little gas masks, and so did I. The gas mask was a little tiny box, probably about 9 inches square, cubed. And inside was this little gas mask, little teensy-weensy gas mask, which had a little sort of nozzle on, a little flap on. And so all of we kids from that day onwards had to take our gas masks wherever we went to school. And every day from the age of 8, my day was started putting on the gas mask and practicing with this blasted gas mask. And you whipped it above over your chin and pulled it over your face, and you had to sit there and try and breathe, which was extremely difficult. Now, of course, the only thing is that the gas mask would only save you for about, I don't know, an hour at the most. And so into the schoolyard where we lived, they built air raid shelters. One level of brick and a slab of concrete on top. If anybody hit that, that would have come down without any worry whatsoever. So then we had to have air raid warnings because the Germans started bombing us almost straight away, as you probably know from the history books. Now, because we were prepared where I was living in Oxford, we had no sirens or anything in those days, in the early days. And this, I love this. We had the local vicar, the Reverend William E. Sawyer, beautiful man, was our local vicar. And so he became the leader of the civil defense. And all of our able-bodied men, well, most of our able-bodied men, were immediately gone into the Army, the Navy, or the Air Force. So I started serving my country at the age of 8. My darling father, who had been in for 34 years and was now 68 years of age, volunteered, and they said, "Terribly sorry, Captain Gore, you're a little bit too old boy. You can't go." So my father sold what we called national saving certificates. You had bonds here, didn't you, in the war?
Yeah.
U.S. bonds?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we call them national. So you bought a certificate for 15 shillings and I think it was sixpence. And if we lived, which we didn't think we were going to, by the way, after the war, we in about 6 or 7 years' time, we were going to get 21 shillings, which was a guinea. So that's what my father did. My mother immediately started knitting socks and scarves and gloves for sailors, not the Royal Navy, the Merchant Navy, who were the unsung heroes of the war. The Merchant Navy are what kept us alive during the war, ferrying in merchandise into Britain. Without them, I wouldn't be sitting here looking at you tonight. So everybody did something. My sister joined the army. She joined the same time as the Queen. A little old queen over there, you know, little Queen Elizabeth, bless her, little cotton socks. Well, the Queen's 80 years old, and my sister's 81, and they both joined the ATS, which is the Army Service, and the Queen and my mother, they didn't serve in the same area, but they were doing the same job, became drivers, and the Queen was a driver during the war. And she used to get her hands dirty and fiddle around with engines and everything. And that's why if ever you see a program about the dear old Queen Liz, you know, you'll see her driving her own Land Rover around her estates in Scotland and that, because she's pretty good at doing it, you see. Mm-hmm. So everybody in my family joined the forces, who was able. They then came and they took away all of our guns from everybody in England because they wanted it for the troops, because we'd left all of our guns over in France at Dunkirk. So they wanted armaments. So Dad had a rifle. He had his service revolver as a hussar officer. And so they took that. I used to play with that, but sadly they took that away. But they did leave us a couple of swords. Dad had his own service sword, and he had a sword he'd got from some poor old German who didn't want it anymore during one of the wars. So Dad and I had a sword each, you see. I had Dad's sword, it was smaller, the German sword, a great big heavy goddamn thing. So I had a sword, and Dad and I were then going to protect, and, you know, if Adolf came, God help him, he'd have a sword, you know. If you ever watch a show called Dad's Army, there's a Corporal Jones there, and he says, they don't like it at them, you know, they don't like it at them. So that's what we would have done, yes. Mm. So we were well armed there. The other thing was the blackout immediately because we knew we were going to get bombed, so we had a blackout. You weren't allowed to have any light showing, no streets lights, no chinks. Anybody came around, we had wardens who'd come around, and they'd knock on your door and say, "You are so in showing some lights out there. Do you mind pulling your curtains too, sir?" You know. So that happened. Rationing started. I never saw an egg for ages. We used to have dried eggs. Which weren't much fun. You'd probably get one sausage a week and half a chop. But that didn't worry us because we were brought up on vegetables and very healthy. The other thing is that where I lived, I measured it tonight because I would not want to deceive you or mislead you. I lived within 2 miles of one of the biggest bomber bases in England. It was an aerodrome when I was a kid called Upper Heyford. I'm only 2 miles as the crow and the airplane flies, 2 miles away. So all through the war, from 1939 right the way through to 1945, we had planes taking off and landing. And so I had planes day in and day out, especially when it was good weather, at Upper Heyford. And I loved it. You know, anybody who complains about living in an airport, this was wonderful. It was like a sense of security, you know. And so from there, we took off and we bombed Germany and all points south, east. And do you want me to finish?
Just pause temporarily.
All right, well, I'm bombing Berlin at the moment.
Yeah, I know. But we're not there yet. We're still in England. Hold on. Hold on. We're going to get to it. Don't worry. We'll get to it. I want to be like this guy right here. You know, I'm serious. Seriously, I aspire to be Robert Goldie. I aspire to live that long, actually. That would be a start. All right, so Pearl Harbor, we've talked about now the invasion of Pearl Harbor. Eventually, we would end up in England. Finally, the Brits would say. Eventually, we would be there. And Robert's life would change. His community would change again as Americans showed up. And tell the story from there, and go ahead and bomb Berlin while you're at it.
Yeah, just briefly, I because I live near this airport, and which was a bomber base, 40 and 41 were terrible. Because 1940, as you probably know from history books, Adolf and the Third Reich were 20 miles away from England. They stood in Calais, and they could fine days, they could see Dover. So Hitler was only 20 miles away, and we now know, and we knew at the time that he was planning it, he was going to invade us, and it was, he'd even got a name for it. It was Operation Sea Lion. And it's only because Goring didn't destroy the British Air Force that he didn't invade. If Goring had destroyed our Air Force, I wouldn't be sitting here today, for sure. So that's how disastrous 1940 was. Plus, bombers were coming over every day. They bombed Coventry, and about 500 German planes flew right over my house. And then air bombers would take off from 2 miles up the road and go and bomb Berlin, Hanover, and all points and south. So that was my life for those 2 years.
Could you see, I think we've all heard stories about how people in the countryside could see the glow of London as...
Correct.
Could you see that?
Yeah. I live 50 miles from London, and there was one, this particular night, it was almost as if the whole of England was ablaze, because London burnt all the time. You know, it'd be bombed heavier in other times than others, but London virtually during the war never went out. But the Germans came over and bombed Coventry, for which we never forgave them, because they bombed Coventry Cathedral, which is still standing there, the old Coventry Cathedral. And as I say, they went over my house that night doing that. And so you got anti-aircraft guns going off, and you got searchlights going and spotting the Germans as they went over. And you could see to the north of me, you could see a glow in the sky. And to the south of me, you could see a glow in the sky. Yes, you could do that, yes. It was almost as if the whole of dear little England was ablaze, yeah. Mm. Anyhow, just talking briefly about the airport, leading into what Rick wants me to do. because I was near this airport, and we hadn't got anybody but our Commonwealth flying for us as well as the Brits. But we had people from Rhodesia, Canada, South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, all in the British Air Force. And so those 2 years before the Americans came over, whenever we had any of our air crews come back deceased, I was a little choir boy. I don't know, same as an altar boy? I don't know. I used to sing a lot too. And we used to bury all of these brave flyers and from overseas in my little churchyard. And our churchyard wasn't big enough to contain all these extra people we were burying. And I went to 22 funerals, because I counted them when I went last home. And we buried all of these overseas guys who volunteered to fly with us from all over the world, average age 20. I don't know what your average age is, but 20. And we had to consecrate some new ground in a churchyard. We took a field from some cows and put some barbed wire up, and the Bishop of Chichester walked around the perimeter, plus me, and we blessed this, and that's where we buried all these guys. And when I go home, I remember that because my dad, bless his dear heart, is buried right next to these 22 very brave flyers. Right, moving right along, in 1941, we're bombing them and they're bombing us almost daily. And then after Pearl Harbor, the Americans eventually, I may use that word, can I? Eventually came to England. And because we got a bomber base, as Bob and I were discussing earlier, obviously we hadn't got bomber bases for all these Americans because we didn't expect them to come. But when they came, we gave them this bomber base up on the road from me called Upper Hayford. Now, also, because we knew there were going to be a lot of casualties, you had to suddenly put in a hospital, an American hospital, for all the casualties. So the airport was 2 miles up the road, and I lived on the Earl of Jersey estate, and he owned all the lands around where we lived. And the Earl of Jersey gave a couple of big fields, not gave, loaned, a couple of big fields to the United States Air Force, and they built a hospital there. So I had an American hospital as a young kid about half a mile from my home. And the first people who came, the first Americans who came there in 1942 were the Mexicans, because the Mexicans were in the American army, but they were the builders, just like they are. They're building a house opposite me right at this moment in Wash Park. Probably the grandchildren of these guys who did it. But anyhow, so the Mexicans came first and built this camp. And I used to love this. So I used to go up there, and I'd never met a Mexican before, you know. So I used to go up the camp with these guys, and they used to give me cigarettes and lead me astray. And that's right, Lucky Strike, Camel, and all that. Oh, gosh. I was the most popular kid at school because I used to deal in these things. nobody else did it but me. So anyhow, then the Mexicans left, and then the rest of the Americans came. And that's where I met three very beautiful Americans. There was a guy called Finn from Nevada. I think he was a cowboy. And there was a lovely guy called Michael Soliotis. He was a Greek-American from Haverhill in Massachusetts. And the other one was a guy called Tip Radford from Pueblo in Colorado. And those two families I'm still very close to, especially the ones over in Haverhill in Colorado, in Massachusetts. And their grandson, my pal's grandson, I went to his wedding only last year when they got married. So it formed a wonderful, wonderful friendship. All of my family were out fighting the war all over, and they're all these Americans. And I was closer to these three Americans from 1942 to 1945 than I was to my own brothers and sisters and uncles and cousins and all that. It's quite amazing. They became my family. And they used to come down to my home from up in the camp and bring us goodies that we'd never seen. You know, they'd bring us some eggs. Only the Yanks had eggs. Only the Yanks had butter. Only the Yanks had meat. Only the Yanks had all the girls. You know that wonderful thing there over here? And yes, I won't go into that one because it's not very nice. Mm. So for 3 years there onwards, from 42 to 45, I virtually lived with the Americans. And when I got hungry, because I was a very fit young guy and I was a champion, an athletic champion in my school, and I swear the reason was I used to go up to the American camp and line up with these guys and have a meal. And, you know, they just accepted me as if I was one of them. And it was a really wonderful period. Is that enough?
Yeah.
Not really, though.
Okay.
These three you knew.
Yes. What,
As the war continued, others, fellow Brits, those that lived in the community, were being called into service. Yeah, no doubt.
Well, they're all gone by then, old boy.
Yeah.
Much to the delight of the Yanks.
Just go ahead and tell them what the over part is, all right? You said the first part. Just tell them the rest of it. Over here.
Oversexed.
Over here, overpaid and oversexed.
That's correct. That's correct. No, there was a lot, you know, I don't want to get too serious about this. There was a lot of jealousy that went on because the Yanks were all very well dressed, lovely clothes. They're poor old British swaddies, which I became one within a few years. We just had one old sort of thick uniform, and the Yanks had all these beautiful olive drabs and all that. In fact, because I was a pretty big boy, fortunately, and they used to give me, I remember that I was one of the best dressed kids at school because we had coupons and you couldn't get clothes in England. You couldn't get food in England, couldn't get clothes in England. So I had a pair of the olive drab trousers, you know, about that color there. And I couldn't go to school in those, so my mother dyed them black. And so I had these beautiful trousers, all the guys had got holes in theirs, you know. And it was a really very interesting time, yes.